Welcome to the All About Alts podcast, where we explore the world of alternative investing to help you find financial independence. Join our host, Newview Trust's president, Jason DeBono, as he covers a variety of topics with different guest speakers to discuss tax and alternative investing strategies. It is never too late to start taking control of your financial future, and we are so excited for you to be joining us for this opportunity to hear from some of the best in the business.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the All About Alts podcast. I am your host, Jason DeBono, and I am joined by a longtime friend, customer, client, business associate. I think I could go on. Mr. Joe Siegel, how are you, sir?
Good. Good to see you again.
Good to see you as well. Now, some of you may know Joe from, I think it was episode 3 of season 1, which hard to believe has certainly been some time ago. But Joe started, really helped us kick off the show with a great episode on setting up LLCs, which actually is, to some new news to me, our top performing podcast to date.
That's good to hear. I'm glad I could help.
Well, anytime you get an attorney, you know, that can share free information, I think people always want to hear it. And Joe, you know, from a legal side, always appreciated not just your understanding of the law, but the way that you've been able to, you know, simplify and break down some of the things that may be complex in the real world, but help us understand it in somewhat layman terms. So, Joe, let's start with, we got a name change on your business, which is super cool. Congratulations. You know, you're continuing to grow. So was Siegel Law, now we're Aspire Legal Solutions. Help me understand that one, that beginning of this year. So what's the why behind it?
Yeah, well, our passion, my mission, the reason I come in the office every day is to help people aspire to a better life. And another one of our core values is be humble. So having Joseph E. Siegel PA as the name of your firm, that doesn't scream being humble to me. It's a sort of a vanity thing to do. So I wanted to get away from that for that reason. And then also wanted to reflect our passion, which is helping people aspire to a better life. So start of the year, 2024, we changed our name. After 20 plus years, we changed our name to Aspire Legal Solutions and moved the website. Everything moved over to aspirelegal.com. So we're starting to see some traction behind that new branding. And I feel more comfortable every day saying Aspire Legal Solutions. The staff's picked it up. The crew loves it. So it's working out really well for us.
That's exciting. Well, that's, you know, it's been amazing, Joe. And I think we met probably close to 20 years ago, and we've been doing some form of business, you know, back and forth through all those years. And it is great. I mean, you're such a great resource. But I do think the Aspire name, it does reflect who you guys are and what you guys do. So congratulations on the continued growth there. Let's pick up maybe where we left off on the last show. And it's, again, been a little bit of time, but we talked about the Checkbook Control LLC. Right. And we talked pros and cons. And I always appreciate when people are willing to hear both the good and the bad, because nothing's perfect. Right. There's things that make sense. And there's some things that you got to do. And one of the things we talked about in that episode was that, you know, when you set up a checkbook LLC, you take on responsibilities. Right. It's not just this simple tool. You have an LLC. You're the designated manager. There's filings, legal, tax, et cetera. But there's some new legislation out in regards to FinCEN related to the Financial Crimes Network. For most people in financial worlds, banks, brokerage, we're so familiar with that term. But I've never heard it until we started talking, you know, about it when this came out. Talk to me a little bit about what this means and help our kind of listeners understand what is FinCEN and now what's FinCEN's new role as it relates to LLCs, specifically checkbook LLCs.
Yeah, happy to. The FinCEN is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And they are in charge of ensuring that the United States, being the largest financial system in the world, is also the most stable and most trustworthy. They do that with a lot of filings. So Congress, a few years ago, came out with the Corporate Transparency Act. And as part of the Corporate Transparency Act, they built in this portion called the BOI report, the Business Owner Information Report, that now has to be made with FinCEN. It went into effect on January 1st this year. And literally on January 1st, FinCEN released their final guidance of their Q&A, their frequently asked questions, everything about how you were going to have to comply with this new BOI reporting requirement. And it boils down to, if you are an entity that has to file with your state or any state to exist. So if you file with the Division of Corporations in Florida, Secretary of State in North Carolina, the SEC in Virginia, to create your corporation, your LLC, or maybe some limited partnership, some trust, business trust in Massachusetts, Delaware, places like that, you have to file a BOI report online with FinCEN to let them know anyone who owns 25% or more of the company, anyone who controls the company, so presidents, officers, managers of the LLC, general partners, the C-level executives, they get all that information. Now, the information actually isn't totally obtrusive. They really just want your names, addresses, and identification. So your driver's license or state ID or your passport number. If you're a foreign person, that becomes a little different, because then it's your passport for whatever your home country is. But they gather all this information, you file it online, and it's kept in a super secret database. It's not top secret, but it's kept at a level of secrecy that other government information is retained that is considered to be secret and confidential, but not super top secret. Because I've had that question come to me a lot, going, well, I'm going to put my information in this database. How do I know somebody's not going to steal my identity? But it's held at a super high level of secrecy. And it's the FinCEN database, where they maintain information from Homeland Security, DEA, IRS, FBI, CIA. I mean, every bit of financial and criminal information is all maintained in the FinCEN databases. And it cross-references so that they can spot criminal activity. And also, when they do find someone, a lot of times, you know, the FBI may go to FinCEN and say, hey, give us all of this person's accounts, because we've actually had that happen to clients in the past, where they come in, they say, how did they know I own all this stuff? And I go, they just go to FinCEN, which then interacts with FDA or FTC, IRS, and pulls all your data into one spot for the FBI to see it. And they have your whole financial picture right there, no matter how you have broken yourself up for tax and asset protection reasons. They can find everything about you through that. So the big thing is now you have to file that if you are an LLC. So that's most of our listeners here are going to have an LLC. And even if it is a self-directed IRA LLC, you still have to file it if you're not exempt under one of the 27 exemptions. So far, I've not had any clients who are exempt if they are actively doing any business. Pretty much you have to file it. And the big question I've had with IRA owners is they go, well, I don't own the LLC. My IRA owns the LLC. So do I report NewView Trust Company as the controlling interest of the LLC? And I did some research, looked around. Other trust companies around the country have taken the stance that ultimately your IRA is controlled by you. Since you control your IRA, you control the LLC, so it should be you reporting you as the controller, as the business owner information that gets reported in the FinCEN report. So that's the way people have been handling it. We've not received any direct guidance from FinCEN on this, and I've subscribed to their email newsletters where they give us automatic updates whenever they update their guidance. And we've not received anything directly about self-directed IRA or retirement account LLCs that are out there. So for now, we're taking the tack that it's the owner of the IRA reports themselves as the business owner of the LLC that's out there on the FinCEN reports. And another thing, I mean, the reason this is all important, everybody's like, well, why do I have to file the report? And it's because there are pretty onerous fines if you don't, built in, that are built into the Corporate Transparency Act. If you filed your LLC, if it existed prior to January 1st, 2024, you have until December 31st, 2024 to file your report. If it was filed after January 1st, 2024, you have 90 days from the date you receive notification it has been filed by the state. Starting next year, you'll only have 30 days to report. And then you have 30 days if there's any changes. So if you change the officers, if you change members, anything like that changes, you have 30 days to update the information with FinCEN to let them know that, that there has been a change in power, authority, or ownership. Now, if you don't, the fines are $1,000 a day, $500 a day. It's pretty onerous. And there are civil penalties, but there's also criminal penalties if they find that you willfully didn't file. So the whole reason behind this is to catch oligarchs and Russian oligarchs and other bad countries using their money and trying to hide it in the United States or through our financial system. And that's ultimately what it is. But the problem is this dragnet's huge, catching everybody. They're expecting about 40 million existing companies will have to file a BOI report before December 31st. And that's a lot of people. We're filing dozens of them a month. And it's just an onerous task. But once it's done, if nothing changes, you're done. You don't ever have to file it again. And it is free. You don't have to pay anything to file it. Has nothing to do with taxes. So get that out of your mind when you're filing it. And yeah, we're just getting a lot of questions about it. And a lot of people wondering whether they're exempt or not. And if they aren't exempt, what do they have to do to file? And we've got a whole page on our website about it that explains it and gives you the links of where you go to file and everything. So pretty big issue right now for anybody who has an LLC.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive issue. And I think, you know, the first part is understanding the why. And, you know, what I've learned with reporting requirements, you don't necessarily have to agree with the why. But, you know, I think you kind of pointed it out. And, you know, for any financial institution, obviously Nuvve's a chartered, public trust company, a regulated financial institution. We submit filings to FinCEN every 2 weeks. You know, again, whether you agree with it or not, what the logic is they just want to make sure that every entity that has the ability to house money or assets has some way or some reporting of who it is. And I think there was a lot of, you know, LLCs and entities were viewed as, you know, anonymity, and there's better ways to kind of hide stuff. And I think if you think about the logic, maybe you've even applied it to your own situation. Hey, if I put this in an LLC, no one will know I have it. While you may not have done it with criminal intent, there's a lot of people standing behind you that are doing it with criminal intent. So, I appreciate you kind of hitting on the key thing is you do it once, right? If nothing changes. And really what you're doing is saying, hey, this entity is owned, controlled, managed, et cetera, by these people so that it can go into the master database right alongside every other financial account. You may not see this today, but every financial account that you have anywhere is being reported through FinCEN. So this is, you know, and even when you open the bank account of the LLC, it's being reported through FinCEN. It's just the way the world works. So really good stuff there. I think one piece that I'll highlight, you know, and we talked about this on the show, when you take on the responsibility of managing an entity, right, in this case, on behalf of your IRA, you've got to stay in the know. Because ultimately, if you don't do this and you get hit with a penalty and they don't catch everybody, but when they do, they certainly make a statement out of it. But $1,000 fine, that's not on Nuvve. We are not, as a trust custodian or any other trust custodian out there, responsible to determine what you have to file on behalf of the LLC. It's not an IRA filing. It's not a filing that's required by a trust company. It's a filing required because you, as the IRA owner, chose to establish an LLC. So just be mindful of that stuff. You know, I'd put that in the pro and the con of having an LLC, right? You gain more flexibility and control. But here's another example of, hey, this is just another kind of slippery slope of things that I've got to be familiar with. What does someone do today, right? If they've got it, I know you've got a page on your website, and I'd encourage everybody, whether, you know, Joe and his firm serve as your legal counsel or not, take advantage of the resource. But what do I do? Let's say I've got four LLCs, right? Three personally and one in my IRA. I probably, you know, have never heard of this. I don't know what it is. I don't work in this world. I'm hearing this going, I'm really glad I heard this, but what in the hell do I actually do? So what, Joe, where do you point me or where can you point our listeners to at least get this squared away, assuming that it's an easy filing and they know what they're doing?
Yeah, it's real simple. You just go to fincen.gov and I think it's /BOI. And from there, it has all the questions and answers that you may have. But then it also has a link and you just click it and you start your filing. And you will put in your information as well as the company's information. And they want, typically they want the EIN number of the company, of the entity. And then you will put in your information. If you're the one doing the filing, you'll put in your information and then you will put in the information in the next screen. You'll put in the information about the shareholders, if it's a corporation, or the members of anyone who owns 25% or more of the company, as well as anyone who's an officer or managers of the company. And that information is typically your name, mailing address, I believe maybe your birth date, and like I said, your driver's license number, your passport number. I believe they'll also take a social security number, but I think most people are instead using driver's license numbers and passport numbers instead to link it. Now, the first filing you do, you can say, hey, I want a BOI identification number for myself. And at that point, when you're done, it will give you your number, your personal number as the filer. And going forward, instead of having to type all your information again and again and again, you can just put your name and your BOI number down and you're done. That your entry's done because now that's going to link you back to that company. And I can't imagine they're not using artificial intelligence to monitor all this stuff, because there's no way human eyes could be watching the amount of data coming in here. But it's fairly simple. Like I said, it's free. It took me, the first one I did took about 30 minutes, but the more you do, the faster you get. And also a little practice tip I've figured out, if you have maybe a master LLC that is owned by another LLC that's owned by a corporation, start with the corporation first, because you'll get a BOI number for it. Then whenever you're telling who owns this LLC, you'll just put its BOI number in here. And then the next one up, you put this one's BOI number in here and you're done. It makes it go much faster. But I did one time where I started at the top and went down. It was actually very difficult to do that. So there's some tips. There are professionals. I mean, we file them for clients. A lot of CPAs have come out and said that they'll file them for their clients. If you are setting up a new LLC, we actually now, as part of our services, when we're doing a new LLC for you, that's part of what we do, is we get your driver's license when you become a client, and we will go ahead and file the BOI report. Once it's filed with the state, we file the FinCEN report, because there are some lawyers and other companies out there that came out and said, well, if your company's not doing this, you know, they're not doing it right. So we said, well, okay, well, then they've just set the standard. Now we have to all do this because everyone just set the standard. So it is an additional service that we provide now. Whenever we form a new LLC of any type, we go ahead and file the FinCEN report too. We're
getting good. Well, that's great that you at least get it done at the time of filing. And I think for most people that becomes the norm. I mean, most filing requirements only feel painful because you got to go backwards, you know, but if we do it on a new LLC at the time of establishment, I mean, honestly, I'd imagine 95% of the people wouldn't even know what actually was filed or who or how, and there's nothing wrong with that. Well, that's exciting stuff. I think certainly we want you guys to listen to the whole episode today, but if you only popped on the first 15 minutes or so, critical update, and just a friendly reminder, you got to stay up to date. And obviously this podcast, and Joe has a podcast as well, they're here to help people understand what's out there. And some of it is theoretical and some of it is practical. And I'd put this today in the very practical bucket, especially since I think most of our listeners have at least one LLC in some capacity, even if it's not just for their IRA. We have so much different things we could talk about, but I think we collectively agreed this show is all about, you know, a quick update. But we're going to spend our time talking about a landmark case that was handed down against the National Association of Realtors. Some people may have heard of it. Hopefully everybody's at least starting to hear about it. I've seen the social media presence over the last couple of weeks since NAR has settled. And you know, they're nobody knows what's coming, but what we do know is that the 6% commission structure and strategy that's kind of been in place for eons, certainly as long as I've ever been around, is going away. So we're going to get to that. So stay tuned. We're going to spend the entire second half of today's show talking about that, what it means. And we're going to get it not just from the opinion of a beat writer writing an article for the newspaper, but actually from the legal side of itself. But Joe, before we get there, we're going to throw you on the hot seat for the quirky questions of the day.
Okay.
So you've done this once. We're not letting you off the hook a second time around, but you're a pro now. So here we go.
Let's see.
And I always forget to add it. Keep the questions coming. We love them. I say it every week. It's my favorite part of the show. You can send those to allaboutalts@newviewtrust.com. All right. Oh, I can see this first one I like already. Joe, what's the most unusual job you think you'd be good at?
Housekeeper for me. I think I would be a good housekeeper because I love to vacuum. It's weird.
Yes, that is weird. But well, Joe, we got to have you over more often and leave the vacuum out when you come.
I do. We have vacuums on each floor of our house. And every morning before I start to go to work, I vacuum at least one floor each day of the house. And it gets my mind set and dust and vacuum. Even though we have housekeepers come in once a week, I still have to clean up before they come in every week.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. That is one I still have yet to understand. My wife will say, "Hey, we've got to clean up. The cleaners are coming." And I'm like, doesn't that defeat the whole purpose of the cleaners? But you know, I lost that battle a long time ago and I've just accepted that's the way it is. So, well, I good to know, Joe, and you've got an incredibly successful career in the legal world, but good to know it. If anything, it's a good hobby. Question number two. Digital watch or analog watch?
Digital all day long. I've worn an Apple Watch now since Apple Watch 2 came out. And anybody who reads my weekly newsletter, email newsletter, will know that I'm a little bit of a freak at collecting data about my health and myself. And the watch helps me do that. The watch and the ring, they both collect constant data about my health, and I can't live without it. I have to wear it all night while I'm sleeping and all day while I'm awake, all the time.
Well, once you have a digital watch, it is really hard. I have a same watch and I cracked it. And I said, "Oh, that's okay. I've got, you know, a couple of traditional watches," and I put them on. I'm like, it just tells you the time. And I threw my watch on 3 or 4 days later. I'm like, looks like I'm going to get a new Apple Watch because it just feels like something's missing through that process. So yeah. It's amazing how digital the world's become.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Question number three. Last question. If you could have an endless supply of any candy or snack, what are you going with?
Reese's Cups. I love peanut butter and chocolate together. I don't care what it is. I gorge on them. It's my thing. It's.
Have you had Justin's, the little peanut butter cups?
No, I haven't had those.
They're in airports. I grab them every time I fly. But take a look up for them. They're called Justin's. I love any sort of dessert based item that says it's healthy, right? Like something doesn't add up. It's chocolate and peanut butter. I get it. There's protein, but don't. Apparently it's a lot less sugar and anyways, but they're actually very good. Here's a question for you. Bonus round. Uh-huh. When it comes to Reese's Cups, are you a purist or will you venture off into the white chocolate peanut butter cups?
Oh, I've had the white chocolate peanut. Yeah, they're fine. I can't tell any difference. To me, it's still chocolate and peanut butter. So I have no, I'm adventurous. I'm wild like that. Yeah.
Well, good to know. Well, so you won't get, if you want to send Joe something nice, he likes fine wine, fine automobiles, as well as Reese's cups. So good, good to know. We'll be ready for Christmas
here. And vacuum and vacuum cleaners.
And vacuum cleaners. That's right. All right, Joe, you're off the hot seat, and we always appreciate the questions and walking through those. They're always a little bit of levity, and especially on a legal discussion, sometimes we need a good laugh. Yeah. Which brings us to, let's just open this Pandora's box. I mean, I kind of teed it up a little bit, and I think you're either in the camp of you're familiar with it, right? And you're kind of dying to understand what it really means, or you're unfamiliar and you're probably familiar enough where you're probably dying to understand what it means. So give us the lowdown on this, Joe. What the heck happened? What was kind of this small case that's become massive and now it's being settled out? So yeah, give us the high level and then we'll dig into it as we can.
Yeah, I first wrote about it about 5 months ago. There was a little case out of, I believe it was Kansas, where the plaintiffs sued National Association of Realtors, as well as some very large brokerages like Keller Williams and RE/MAX and others, saying that they were all colluding on commissions structures so that it was driving the price of housing up and closing costs for buyers, and because now the house price had to go up to cover the commissions. And RE/MAX, I think, was one of the first to settle. Keller Williams eventually settled. Most of the brokerages settled. And their settlement was simple. Hey, we're not going to require our agents to be members of National Association of Realtors. We're not going to require them to share commissions. We're not going to require them to even talk about commissions with any agent who brings a deal to them. And we'll pay a lot of money to the plaintiffs. The National Association of Realtors came down and said, well, we're going to settle too. We're done. Number one, we're going to pay the plaintiffs $418 million over the next 4 years. Number two, we are going to remove by mid-July the box in all MLS multiple listing service databases across the country. We will remove the box that says the cooperating agent, the buyer's agent, will receive X percent of the commission. And number three, we will, by mid-July, require all realtors in the country, if you are representing a buyer, you will have a written buyer's agency brokerage agreement with the buyer, spelling out that you get paid by the buyer, not necessarily by the seller. I explained this to one of our employees here, because he and his brother were looking for a house a few months ago, and they ended up buying a house. And I said, look at that, because he didn't understand what we were talking about. So to explain it, I said, you had an agent working with you, right? He said, yeah. I said, now that agent got paid by the listing agent for the seller. You didn't pay them a dime, correct? He said, no, we didn't pay them a dime. He said, we couldn't afford to pay this person anything. We were scraping together the money just to make the down payment and the closing costs. I said, perfect. Now, under the new rule, that listing agent will not automatically pay your agent out of their commission. You would have had an agreement with that agent that if the seller does not agree to pay your agent, you're going to pay your agent something, either a flat fee or a percentage of the purchase price or something. Something will be agreed to that you would have paid them. He said, then we couldn't have bought the house. There's no way. Because that there's just no way we could have paid that person. And I said, now let's talk about what your agent did. Could you have gotten closed without that buyer's agent? He said, no. He said, mortgage started going sideways toward the end. She was there to pull it back together and hold it together, help his brother out who had never bought a house before, help him out with financing, help him out with getting with the right mortgage broker. Home inspections. That buyer's agent was there to meet with the home inspector and then go, hey, these things need to be fixed. They come up with some big ticket items. I've got a plumber. I've got a roofer. I've got a handyman. Let me get all these people together and then give me an estimate of how much it's going to cost to see if we can come down on the price or see, at least let you know what you're getting into. You know, these are things that the buyer's agent does. In addition to showing you houses and finding properties for you, these are the kind of things that the buyer's agent does. I've had a buyer's agent before working on closing where the appraisal came back really low. And the buyer's agent said, wait, let me see the appraisal. They go through the comparable properties that the appraiser used and realized that they had, the appraiser had miscalculated the number of bathrooms in one of the comps. So they go, no, this had four bathrooms, not three. If you put in four there, how does it work? He put in four bathrooms, boom, suddenly it appraises. The appraisal was right because the appraiser had simply made a mistake that the buyer's agent caught, not the listing agent, but the buyer's agent. So, you know, this is the kind of thing, things that the buyer's agents do. And, you know, I was licensed as a realtor when I was 18, 19 years old in North Carolina. And I was a broker up there until just this past year. I finally let my license lapse up there this current year. And I've been a broker here in Florida for years. So I understand that side of the business, where your loyalties lie and what you have to do and what you have to do. And I had title companies for I was in title for 27 years. So I worked closely with realtors for over almost three decades. And so I know what the value proposition is of a buyer's agent. I know what they bring to the table. And I've compared it to, you know, they're like the ball bearings in this fidget spinner. You know, they help grease the wheels of real estate transactions nationwide, because if you got two agents working together, they have experience, they have knowledge, they have connections, and things just sort of sail through a lot more smoothly than if you only have a listing agent or no agent at all, and it's a buyer and a seller who have a lot of emotions, a lot of ignorance. They simply just don't know things. And I'm afraid that simply this one change, which a lot of people are saying, hey, it's no big deal. They're taking a box off. And so you're not automatically going to get you're not automatically going to know up front what percentage of the commission you're going to get. And there are going to be some listing agents out there who go, no, I'm only getting 1%. I'm only getting $1,500. I only got $495. I'm not paying you a dime, you know, for this. And there's nowhere in the MLS for the seller even to say, hey, I will pay buyer's agents X percent or X amount of dollars if you bring a buyer to me. They've taken that out of the MLS. So it's like this grease in the wheel is now gone and it's just not spinning anymore. I think it's just really going to slow down transactions in the United States. It's going to gum up the works, at least for a while, until people learn how to work with it. But I think it's really going to slow down the velocity of money that is created with real estate transactions. And I talked to clients, you know, from Canada and the UK about how they do it there. And they go, well, in the UK, this is normal. It's how we do it. We wouldn't have, you know, agents anyway. It's, and Canada's the same way. And I go, okay. So you compare the portion of the GDP of the housing and real estate market, and the housing and real estate market is 7% of the UK's GDP. And the UK is a much smaller economy than the United States. The United States is the largest economy in the world. Real estate is 17% of our GDP. So a judge and an NAR and a plaintiff have just really sort of gummed up the works for 17% of our GDP. And that's trillions of dollars that they just played with simply by removing data entry boxes on the MLS. And we're going to see what happens, but it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be good.
Well, and for the sake of discussion today, I'm going to play a little devil's advocate, right? Because and I am not an overreaching regulatory, you know, less is more in my eyes. But one thing that's always troubled me, right, and I know it's not necessarily at the heart, but it is core to kind of what this was about, is it's always troubled me that there's a fixed fee, right? We live in a world where we have antitrust laws. My family growing up owned a gas station. And if we talked to the neighboring gas station about how much we were going to sell our gas for, we were in violation of antitrust. And this is a little tiny town and a little small gas station, right? Yet homes are being sold with such, in my eyes, a clear violation of antitrust because it's 6%. And I'll tell you a quick story. I sold a house in 2007, right? The market was just at its peak. It was actually on its way down. I had bought a house in 2005. I was trying to sell out of it. And it was, I walked away from closing with $90, right? 90 bucks. I mean, it was a blessing knowing what real estate did. But when I tried to ask about this 6% that was now being tacked on that got me to the 90 bucks, I was told you can't sell your house for less than 6%. No buyer's agent will show your house. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm a buyer's agent, right, my job's to help my client get into the best possible property. If I'm only going to look at the properties that pay me more money, I'm violating my own fiduciary responsibility. So in the finance world, that's taboo, right? It's bad, bad, bad. Yet the largest purchase any one person in their lifetime will make is likely their house. Yet how's that not an antitrust issue? So help me with that side of it, Joe, because I do agree with gumming it up and paperwork, and they're going to have to figure it out. They will. But let's talk about that commission. Do you see it getting cheaper? And then I'll also have one other point I want to talk about from a buyer's side, but we'll touch on that after this one. But yeah, what says you, Joe?
Yeah, there will be a commission compression, and there will probably also, you'll probably also see the price of homes falling. And let me go into both those. The commission compression will come from number one, people will say, well, the large firms like CoreLogic, Redfin, Zillow, they will be the listing agents, and it's just, they just put it online and people have a lot of flat fee. So if you're a seller, you could go to a flat fee agent and list your property for a flat fee of, you know, $495 with maybe some a la carte services of, oh, well, if you don't want a drone service, if you want a 3D mapping of the interior of the house, if you want pictures of by a professional, we'll add these on for your listing, but you pay a flat fee and you're done. And we'll put it in the MLS for you, but it's going to have no compensation listed for a buyer's agent. So good luck. Good luck trying to sell that house. And there's never been, I mean, and I've gone to a lot of realtor conferences, and they always start just about every educational session and every meeting with the reminder of, we don't discuss compensation here. We don't discuss levels of compensation because that violates antitrust. I mean, so everybody has it in the forefront of their mind. And you're absolutely right. 6% has pretty much been the standard as long as I've been practicing since 1996. And that's North Carolina, Florida, everywhere I've ever been. It's been around 6%. You know, lately, last year, whenever there were not that many listings and there were a lot of buyers or you would see 5% or 4.5%, or you could, I mean, and that's the thing, you could always still negotiate, but what your realtor was really saying is, and I've had this said to me too, when I'm listing a house, because I say, well, let's just do 5%, 2.5, 2.5. We'll pay the buyer's agent 2.5. We'll pay you 2.5. And the listing agents I work with are usually very experienced and very knowledgeable. And they go, okay, well, think about that, Joe. If I'm looking at a house and they're same spiel you got, if I've got a buyer and I've got a house that's like yours and another house down the street and they're offering me 3 and you're only paying 2.5, which one do you think I'm going to show first? And which one do you think I'm going to really ooh and ah about when I'm walking through the house? And, you know, it's home. So frankly, I mean, the last couple of times we've sold a house, we actually added a kicker to the buyer's agent of 1 to 1.5% extra if they brought us a buyer that executed a contract that ended up closing, but that contract had to be executed within the first 2 weeks of the listing. So we paid extra incentives to buyer's agents to get it sold. And that's all gone now. So I won't even have that opportunity anymore to put it out there to say, hey, buyer's agents, I'll pay you even more if you bring me a buyer faster and sooner because I got to sell this house quick kind of thing. And, you know, 1.5% is no big deal. But, you know, now you've got, they've got to, the buyer has to, it's on their shoulders. They're going to have to pay it. So a lot of buyers are just going to say, well, I can't work with an agent. I can't afford to take that chance that I find a house and I fall in love with it. And the seller just says, no, I'm not paying a commission to your agent. And now I've agreed that I will pay them a minimum. You know, maybe my agreement is I'll pay them a minimum of $3,500 or $4,000 or $5,000 for all the time that they've spent and all the time they will spend getting me into this property. Another thing we're going to see, and so that goes to compression of commission values of what, so yeah, you're going to see a lot of flat fee listing agents come up. You're going to see a lot of a la carte services offered by buyer's agents rather than getting a 3% or 2.5% of the sales price of the house. Now they're going to be getting, well, I'll charge you $250 to do your contract. And then I'll charge you $100 for every house I show you. And I'll charge you, by the mile, if you're riding in my car to go see a house. And, you know, who wants to pay that? What buyer wants to pay that other than, well, buyers who are wealthy enough to go, hey, I can afford to pay an agent. Yes, I'm going to have my own representation. I'm going to have an agent. I'm going to have a lawyer represent me to make sure this goes right. So in another way, it also widens that have and have not gap. Those who have, wealthy people, can afford an agent. Those who have not, which are usually first-time home buyers, veterans, they're not allowed to pay a realtor any commission by law under the terms of FHA and VA guidelines. They can't pay their realtor anything. So now they're not allowed to have a realtor. They can't sign a buyer's agency agreement where they're obligated to pay an agent a certain amount of money if the seller does not agree to pay. So then where it brings me to my next prognostication of you're going to see price devaluations, because now to get to that seller being able to pay your buyer's agent something, it's sort of like, you know, in the old days you'd go, well, I want the seller to pay 3% of the sales price toward my closing costs. Okay, fine. We'll bump the price up by 3% and they'll pay that. Well, now you're going to go, but my agent needs to get paid too. So I can't afford closing costs. I'm a first-time home buyer. Can't afford closing costs. I can't afford to pay my agent. Can we bump the price up by 6%? And then you pay 6%, 3% goes to my realtor and 3% goes toward my closing costs. And then if they had an agent, they're already up 3% to cover that agent's commission to get to their bottom line of what that seller wanted to take away from closing. The seller says, sure, fine, we'll do that. Well, the problem is his neighbor down the street didn't do that for his buyer. So now his property sold a month ago for 10% less than you're selling this property for. There's no way the property's going to appraise. So now your buyer can't get the loan. So the deal dies anyway, because it's going to, when some sellers are bumping their prices up and others aren't having to cover realtor commissions, the price equivalencies are going to get out of whack, and appraisers are going to have to know, well, did you pay the buyer's agent or did the buyer pay the buyer's agent? How'd this work? What incentives did you give? And they're going to have to factor all that in. And it's another factor that affects the overall valuation of properties across the board and can pull them down, because buyers start going, well, I just can't afford the house. I can't afford it because nothing else appraised in this area for that, because everybody else paid their own realtor buying it. And I can't bump the price up to cover my realtor. So I just can't buy this house. So I'm out, and you'll have deals canceling. So you're going to have price compression as well as commission compression in the long run.
Yeah. And you know, I agree with the validity of the points. I think the market's going to figure it out. You know, I think it's a change, and certainly with change, there's risks of lots of things going sideways. And you know, some of the FHA and VA guidelines, yeah, I mean, they're going to have to fix those, right? You can't, I don't think anyone should be excluded out of the market. But, you know, there's two other sides to this that you know, just for dialogue, again, not to debate. You know, one thing that's always bothered me about the real estate commissions is, you know, it was no harder to sell my home in 2021 than it was in 2014, right? And I bought two homes in that period and the value tripled. So I paid three times the price, right, of my commission, yet the effort wasn't three times the amount of effort required to sell it. So I think you've got some interesting things to solve, but it certainly creates some new challenges. And I think your points are very valid on the challenges it creates. But there is an element of rising home prices is automatically like extra money in the pocket for an agent at the expense of the seller, right? And now I think we tolerated under the idea that, well, Joe, your house tripled, right? Cry me a river, pay your 6% and move on. But the reality is nothing else in our lives are we required, right, to pay triple, even tipping. I know this is going to sound super silly and cheap, but, you know, if food has gone up 25, 35, 45, 60% and my 15 to 25% tip is now 25% higher. So there's some parallels there that the market doesn't account for or adjust for when you have a percentage-based activity. But the same is true for periods of stagnation, right? Real estate doesn't change for 10 years and then it shoots up. You got a lot of realtors that worked harder. So yeah, double-edged sword.
Well, and that's not an argument I'm hearing for the first time. And I agree with you. And I've never heard, at least yet, I have not heard a realtor come back to me with a good value proposition argument against that. To me, and I agree with you, yeah. Okay, so property values have gone through the roof, but you're still getting 6%. And so now instead of when you're listing my property, you have drone footage and maybe 3D interior mapping that you do, and maybe hire a professional photographer that you didn't do 10 years ago when it was worth three times less. But is that really worth three times more of the commission? I would love to hear a listing agent, especially, give me that explanation of why they're 3%. Now, a lot of listing agents I know did drop their side because they're like, yeah, your price has gone through the roof and I'm making a good living. A lot of listing agents went to just the flat fee services, a la carte menu. And I think we'll see the buyers do that. Buyers agents do that a lot. They'll go to the a la carte menus for their buyers who can pay. For the others, I think the market will sort, the way it'll work out is the way the commercial market works. Commercial doesn't really have a formal MLS, so to speak, for listing commercial property. So for instance, we were in the market looking for a new office building last year, 2 years ago. And one of the things our agent would do is he would identify potential properties, send them to us. We'd go, yeah, that looks good. That looks good. Before he would show us the property, he would call the listing agent and say, hey, I've got buyers. Here's how they're qualified. Here's what they're looking for. I want to show them the property. They want to see the property. What's the commission split? How does the commission work on this? What will you do? And the broker at that point would say, oh, well, we'll give you 1%. We'll give you 2%. We'll give you 3% of whatever we get, you know, or of the sales price, because we're going to get 8% or 9% or whatever, and we'll give you this much. So they had to hammer that out every time before we saw a building. Commercial moves a lot more slowly.
Yeah.
In this country, commercial is it crawls compared to housing. And that's where I'm saying the velocity of money is going to slow down in the country, because the faster people buy houses, the faster they buy a new car. Most people buy a brand new car within 1 year of buying a new house. They buy new furniture, they buy new clothes, they have renovations done. So it creates this just demand in the economy. Every time a new house is sold, it creates this huge demand that just ripples through all sectors of the economy. And I really think that's going to slow down quite a bit if this also slows down the speed at which real estate transactions can occur on a macro level. That's just my two cents.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot to be said. I mean, the velocity of money, and you bring up all the ancillary things, right? We're talking commissions, but for every action, there's a reaction, right? And so I do absolutely agree there's some changes there. And, you know, I don't know exactly where I stand on it. You know, I think in every landmark case, there's winners and losers. And, you know, but one thing that I am always certain of is that the free markets, and this is why, you know, I do believe in a free market, is the free markets will figure it out. You know, one last point as we close out, I'd love to get your feedback. You know, that is interesting is, as a buyer's agent today, you really don't get paid to your buyers buy a house. And if you kind of think about every other service, right, that exists, like, it's not whether or not you do your job, it's whether or not all these other factors play in. It's almost like saying, I'm going to be a server and I don't get paid unless you know, love your meal. Well, gosh, do I want my paycheck to be dependent on the cooks or this, you know, whatever it is. So there's something that I see, you know, and I've got a lot of friends in the real estate business. I think it's a fantastic profession. And a lot of them do it really well. And there's a lot that do it really poorly, right? Every profession has that. But for buyer's agents to be able to at least start getting some sort of monetization for their activity maybe not as big a payoff at the end, but being able to get paid. I know agents that have shown 20 houses, and when the market's cooking, which isn't, and I'm a real estate investor, my clients are real estate investors, I don't think the market going up 20% is great at all. I'd give me my 7% market and I'll make money the rest of my life on real estate. But at 20%, you know, you can't, people can't buy houses. It's not a cost issue. They can't even get into them. So there's some things there that may actually help slow down and make it more affordable. So I may have to pay you, Joe, my buyer's agent, $3,000 out of my pocket, but I don't have to put in 22 offers over 6 months and have the emotional roller coaster. I can put in two and maybe pay $5,000 less than what I'd have paid in that market. So what do you see on that? And do you think you're going to see buyer's agents kind of take that stronger approach to start maybe getting paid by the hour or paid by, you know, the activity versus the transaction?
Yeah, that's a good question. The consensus is, and I can also tell you hundreds of horror stories where buyer's agents that I know drove people around for months, showed them houses, put in several offers, and then all of a sudden they just don't hear from the buyer anymore. And when they do hear from the buyer, they're like, wait, what happened to you? I've been calling you. Oh, we walked into this builder down the road. They're building a new development. We walked in, we just signed a contract there. And you didn't tell them I'm your agent? Well, no, because you're not my agent on that one. So I just wasted 3 months of my life with you. Yeah, yep. That was very common. So in North Carolina, it was very common to have a buyer's agency agreement. And I agree that you've got that. And your buyer is clear and they understand you're my agent on any deal I do. It's pretty much exclusive. And you will get paid, whether it's from me or from someone else. You're going to get paid. Flip side of that coin. So yeah, buyer's agents know, okay, I'm going to get paid. I've got a contractual agreement. I'm going to get paid. Procuring calls, all that crap goes out the window now. We don't need to worry about it because I've got an agency agreement. I'm getting paid. But the double-edged sword of that is now how many buyer's agents will go, well, these people can't afford me and those people can't afford me and they can't afford this. So I'm not going to take my risk on them that if I can't, that I'm not going to get paid. So I'm just not going to take it. Now, what if those people are from protected classes? They tend to predominantly be from protected classes. Now you're violating fair housing laws because you're just turning away everybody because you're like, they can't afford me. I'm not going to take them on as a client because I know they can't afford me and I don't want to take a chance. I'm going to do all this work and not get paid in the end because they're a VA buyer or they're an FHA buyer first time. And I'm not going to be able to get paid from them if the seller won't pay me. So I'll just be screwed out of it, out of any money. So I'm just not going to take the case. Now you're going to have fair housing violations start popping up against agencies and brokerages because of that. So it's a fine line they'll have to walk. Estimates have been as high as 1 million realtors will leave the profession at least because it's just not going to be worth it. However, I've also heard that 49% of the realtors out there only sell one house a year anyway. So, you know, if that's the million that leave, if that's the 49%, if they all leave, I don't think it'll be a huge loss. I think the buyer's agents who can team up with great listing agents and those listing agents say, hey, if you ever bring me a deal, I don't care what my seller says, I am paying you because you're going to get this deal done for me. And those buyer's agents with experience and who can articulate that value proposition to their buyer of what they are going to do for them and what the value of that is, they will survive. They'll do fine. And the ones who also come up with their flat fee services, hey, I'll do this for you for this. And I have a menu here. You pick what you want me to do and I'll do it. Just like the flat fee listing agents do. They got their menu, pick from it, and I'll do for you what you want me to do. And this is what you're going to pay me. And you're going to pay me no matter what. I get paid. So those will all play into the calculus of this, of how it all comes together over time. But I really do. The ones who are on the edge are going to fall off and go find jobs doing something else. The ones who have made a career of it and a profession, they will remain. And like I said, I think we'll see a lot of teaming up between great listing agents and great buyer's agents who will work together and agree that, you know, hey, if you ever bring me anything. And the good buyer's agents, will be out there marketing to the great listing agents saying, look, I bring buyers who are qualified, who are going to close. I've got experience. I can get them closed. I'll make sure that their loan goes through. I'll make sure the inspections are done right. I'll make sure, you know, everything's done fair and above board and transparently, but we will work together and we'll get this job done. And as a listing agent, I will make your job easier as a listing agent than if you are just going to sit back and say, well, I'm a listing agent. I'm going to get paid no matter what. And I don't care. I'll just bring in buyers left and right. I think that those listing agents are being foolish and are probably going to have a lot more deals fall through, or they're going to be working both sides of the deal, trying to keep it, hold it together, which then puts you in this conflict state, makes it really difficult. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of years. The real estate industry as a whole is just going through the stages of grief right now, you know, denial, bargaining, anger, everything of the stages of grief. And I think once they work through that and they just start, okay, being pragmatist about it, this is the state of how it is. This is how we're going to deal with it. And this is what we're going to do. Those realtors who get to that state faster and start dealing with it sooner before July gets here, they'll be ready for it. The ones who aren't watching this podcast, the ones who aren't paying attention to the news coming out every day about it, they're the ones who will leave the industry and never come back.
Yeah. Well, and you know, consolidation comes to every industry, and there are, to your point, you know, a lot of realtors that they've got a license, but they're not active. And so hopefully, you know, I don't want to see anyone in this process. You know, you hope that cases like this clean up the little bit of rough around the edges, and you know, we'll see where this goes. I mean, I do think the free market will figure it out, but yeah, in that process, there's going to be winners and losers. And I think your point of the ones that are out in front of it, that are active, that are thinking about it and understanding it, you know, they may not be winners, but they won't be losers, right? So a lot to unpack. I mean, boy, we could talk probably for another 2 hours, you know, and we could even swap seats on, you know, what side of each, you know, particular item you sit on, because there are a lot of pros and cons. It's really, I'd say in the 20 years I've been in the real estate business in any capacity, I'd say it's probably the most landmark piece of legislation that's just been so disruptive. But that Band-Aid slowly being ripped off, we're just not sure what that's going to look like. So more to come. Joe, love having you on the show. Love chatting with you. Fun to play devil's advocate. We usually are always so locked in and thinking the same way. So thanks for having a little bit of fun and letting me take that stance. Any parting words before we wrap up?
Just thanks a lot for having me on. If anybody ever has any questions, feel free to reach out to me. And I've got email is the best way to get me. So just email me and I'll get back to you. I'm happy to talk to anybody.
Awesome. Well, Joe, we appreciate all you do for us and the resource that you are for many of our clients. We'll throw Joe's contact info and the Aspire Law Firm information down in the show notes if you guys want to reach Joe or anyone else from his office. Joe, last question, season two, what keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night? Usually, literally writing the newsletter every week. I'm usually up till 2-3 every night doing that. But no, concerns, worry are things like, how is this going to change this NAR settlement? How is this going to change the industry for me as a real estate lawyer? How is it going to change it for real estate investors who use buyer's agents? How is it going to affect sellers? How's it going to affect the economy as a whole? You know, I'm always thinking about these things, and that does keep me awake at night of how are we going to deal with this change? But, it's growing, it's changing. You got to think, there is nobody alive in the United States right now who has ever been alive when the commission in a real estate residential transaction was not already pre-negotiated just through the MLS, because it's been around that long. So this is a major shift. And yeah, having been a realtor longer than I've been a lawyer, or not a realtor, but a licensed broker longer than I've even been a lawyer, it's disconcerting. But, and at the same time, it's exciting. It's invigorating. It's sort of like when COVID hit, it's like, hey, this is something new. It's really going to test us. It's a challenge. Let's really get out there and see what we can do with it. What opportunities is this going to present to us and to our clients? And that I think is that's what's keeping me up at night, just getting not so much worry, but being excited about the opportunities that it could open up for everybody.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt, you know, given your legal practice as well as your real estate, you know, brokerage, you have to be thinking long and hard about what does this mean, and uncertainty and change, you know, are never fun, but usually if done right, they can hopefully do more good than harm. So time will tell. Joe, thanks for being on the show. Always good to see you. We'll look forward to having you. Maybe we'll bring you back for season 3. And we'll put a little bit more of a bow on this. I'd imagine we'll have a lot more info then. But until then, be safe, be well. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the show. Don't forget to hit the like, share, and subscribe button and keep more people tuned in so we can keep sharing great information and great guest content like Mr. Siegel today. But thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope the information within this podcast has given you the tools that you need to find your way to financial independence. We would love to partner with you on this journey. Text ALTS, that's ALTS, to 407-708-1853 to learn more about how to get started today. Don't forget to follow us to make sure you don't miss a second of content, and we'll see you next week.